Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about United Healthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Anoush and I'm joined by my colleagues Alva Ray and Stephen Bush to discuss going back to work and why the government wants us to do it and why it's so confusing. And you ask us, does the Captain Hindsight criticism of Keir Starmer put him in danger? So we're recording on Monday, and it was last Friday that Boris Johnson first started ramping up the rhetoric about more people going back to work if they can. And he's been reiterating that message today. And there's a huge amount of confusion because while the official guidance that's written down says that if you can still work from home, you should work from home, it seems from ministers that they would rather people started trying to go back to their places of work. And it seems obvious that the reason for this is because although they've had their Super Saturday and they've you know, reopened pubs and shops and restaurants and all sorts of places, that you don't get as much footfall and therefore revenue in these places unless people are actually going into their offices and to their workplaces again. So what is the actual guidance and why is it so confusing? Stephen, you wrote about this in Morning Call.
Yeah, so the actual guidance remains that you should work from home if you're able. I'm so self-indulgent on this issue. I've actually written another piece on this as well, because I genuinely think that the confusion on this comes back to a policy that people who are particularly attentive to my many terrible and actually quite right-wing opinions will be aware I have views on, which is the incoherence of the recent Conservative turn on high streets. This whole, like, we've got to save the high streets. Well, save them from who? Oh, you mean save them from the predictable consequences of people's preference for the convenience and lower cost of online shopping. And of course, the central reason why people are working from home is, and we shouldn't forget that many places moved to working from home before a formal lockdown,
yeah,
is because businesses decided that their personal preference was to A, avoid liability, B, to avoid sick days. Something everyone seems to have forgotten, I think, because like the tail risk and you'll die of the novel coronavirus is obviously important, but it kind of distracts me from the fact that, like, to be incredibly selfish about it, right? Like, obviously, at the moment, I only have a team of one. But when we went into lockdown, I had a team of three people on the politics team. And if I was going to have a situation in which people were going to be ill for 2 weeks, reinfecting each other, then getting ill in 6 months, right, the challenge of effectiveness and, you know, not being within, you know, threatening distance of the people I manage. I'm kidding.
They left because they had other jobs to go to rather than COVID related.
Yeah.
No, or Stephen related, hopefully.
They're not dead. They've just gone to another place. Anyway, right, the inconvenience of a third of my staff being ill all the time is actually greater to me than the undoubted inconvenience of people not being nearby. And I think lots of the benefits of being in a shared space are benefits of being able to not having to be a meter apart, right? It's not like you can have a discreet and informal conversation with someone very easily while observing, you know, in a COVID secure workplace. So the business case for not going back is incredibly strong. I think in the long term, if at the end of this crisis, you know, if there is a vaccine, if it goes away, et cetera, I think that businesses which have retained the ability to do person-to-person working will have considerable benefits. And I think it's particularly difficult and unfair for people who are at the start of their careers. But I also just think, ultimately, from a bottom-line perspective, of course people are going to do this. Just as from a bottom-line perspective, of course, regrettably, in my view, a lot of people prefer Amazon to a brick-and-mortar bookstore. And I think like the thing that this reveals is that we have a government which is just incapable of saying to people, look, here is a hard choice for you. Here is a hard message. Because what they desperately want is they don't want to compel businesses to go back. They don't want to compel people to like start going back out and stimulating Pret. But they would like those things to happen. So you just end up with this kind of like verbal blancmange of people like who are of a government which is kind of too like weak to go, we actually just do want you to take this bigger health risk to deal with the economic problem. I think that is why they're so confused.
I think you also made a good point, Stephen, that the government is basically shifting the burden of liability onto businesses with this move, in that if businesses are requiring people to be physically present in the office and they get sick and they have the long-term ramifications of COVID, it would be on the business rather than necessarily on the government, unless the government changes its position on this, which I think is quite a good one, as in quite a good point. Not a great thing to be happening. But in terms of the bigger thing, I think that it's the very stuff of recessions, isn't it? That even if people have the option of returning to work in an office when they could be working from home, it's like what we were talking about last week, that in the wider economic context of huge uncertainty around job losses and what's going to be like a really, really bad downturn or like a really, really big economic shock, people want to be saving. And I think that being forced, some people have lost their jobs and they aren't in this situation. Lots of people have been going into work the whole time. But for the chunk of people who haven't lost their jobs and who've been able to work from home, especially, as you say, people at the start of their careers, they're suddenly reaping the benefits of like not spending on their commute, not spending on sort of unnecessary purchases, which would be the first things to go if you were saving. And in the context where you might want to be, you know, saving for future job losses, or you don't know what the future is, like there's really like, even if you miss your colleagues or whatever, and you have the option of going back in, it doesn't seem like anyone would want to take on the economic hit of suddenly, as you say, like propping up Pret a Manger and TFL or whatever it is, that people, I think, in many cases would be personally prioritizing their economic security over like doing their bit to help the economy. And that's like the fundamental problem with all recessions, that people want to save when really they could prop up the economy more by spending, but they rightly don't want to.
Definitely. And I think all of this, because, you know, so much of COVID-19 is an exposure of pre-existing problems or an acceleration of pre-existing problems, or even not even problems, but patterns. And I think what this particular debate has exposed about this government is how deeply conservative and uncreative it is. For all of its sort of aura of having this kind of maverick at the heart of it and wanting to shake things up and change the way that the economy is run, it really is, like Stephen said at the beginning of the podcast, it's clinging on to this kind of myth of the British high street. You know, the British high street has been dying for a really long time. Last year, it was declared the worst year for British retail ever. And by trying to get people to go back into their offices, but not really wanting to tell companies to do it, you know, in a mandatory way, they're just sort of clinging on to this idea that the high street can somehow survive when it wasn't before, rather than thinking of a new model for the way that that works. You know, there's long been a problem with the way that it's funded, councils and business rates and the high rents and also just consumer behaviour changing with the times. And there's just such a lack of creativity as to how to grapple with that problem. Which is, you know, which could be a huge opportunity for the kind of things that this Conservative government is known to want to do, which is kind of rejuvenate the towns that lent them their votes in the last election, you know, have a different kind of role for town centres, have this renewal that captures people's imaginations after so long of seeing their high streets degrade. It doesn't show any ambition to do anything different. And I think it's the same with working as well, working practices. Going into an office at an arbitrary location every day for office workers, you know, it has been something that's been declining as as a sort of efficient way to work for quite a while. And so there's all sorts of things that they could be doing to sort of adapt to the times, to the changing sort of face of modern work. But you can just see that it hasn't at all addressed those issues. And all of these things should have been subjects that were at the front of a Conservative government with the ambitions that it says it has its mind while it was going into the election even, but it clearly hasn't thought about them. And rather than using this sort of break and the sort of fractures in the economy that the pandemic has caused to create something new and to deliver on what it says it wants to do by shaking up the old norms, it's trying to cling on to the old status quo, which is deeply revealing of this government.
Yeah, it is odd how, in some ways, right, what we're talking about is both the revealed preferences of businesses and consumers, many of which have gone, actually, we're quite happy working from home, and the revealed preferences, you say, of this government, right? But obviously, as people will know, I am like a massive like London supremacist, and I actually find the idea that people would voluntarily choose to leave the city painful and revolting to me, right? But I kind of have to concede that if what we have shown is that someone can, you know, do a high-powered job in London successfully while living in Cornwall or Redditch or another town than I personally... Now, I'm sure these places are perfectly lovely, but I personally just find the idea of not living in London quite upsetting. But my point is that this is, as you say, Anoush, surely this is an economic change they should be greeting. Mm. Yes, it's disruptive, but we're continually told, you know, this Downing Street loves to brief how much it loves disruption. And like, yeah, the second it gets a disruption which moves us in the direction we want, that annoys even a couple of people. It's like, oh no, please, please, my high street. It's just like, it's just a degrading way for a government to behave. Like...
Yeah, no, it is. And also, I think maybe there's a reason for that, which is that the sort of future of high streets can go two ways. They can just fall completely into the lap of property developers and people who want to extract money from housing in areas that they otherwise have no interest in putting any value into, other than big shiny buildings that exclude certain people. Or they can go in the other direction, which is to sort of be spaces for entertainment, leisure, sort of community activities, public space, those kind of forums that, as we've been writing about at the New Statesman, have been disappearing from local communities for quite some time. And if it was to go in the latter direction, you know, I suppose that would be a slight reversal of the capitalist norm that we have that kind of props up the way that our high streets and town centres work. We had a guy called Bill Grimsey who used to run Wix and Iceland back in the day write for us about this, and he said really the future for our town centres are in activities, in those kind of services that are events and sort of people driven rather than just retail, shopping and restaurants. And, you know, I think maybe that's a bit of a threat to a Conservative government.
It's so interesting as well, because I think like the other side of that coin is the sort of the what Stephen was kind of hinting at, the levelling up potential of what might happen if you suddenly lean into this trend of working from home rather than away from it. Because as you were saying, suddenly this in some ways democratizes access to high paid work and doesn't centralize it in London in the same way. Like, I've been very struck over the pandemic by the way the second people had the option to work from home, people of my own age in their mid-20s, obviously most of the people I know like live and work in London, and the second the pandemic hit, they all spread out across the UK again to their hometowns and have been based there while still doing their, in theory, London-based jobs. And if that was in theory something more sustainable, it would really radically shake up the way certain firms recruited. And suddenly, rather than having this huge brain drain from certain towns that don't have the work to pay graduates or can't retain their young people, suddenly those young people could be based in their hometowns again. And I don't know if the government has looked into this in a serious way, but maybe looking at like the long-term modelling of what might happen if you had more home working for these kinds of roles, and the knock-on effect that would have, not necessarily on town centres, but on towns as a whole, and the sort of levelling up the the economic productivity of the UK. I mean, I'm sure quite quickly it would mean that people based in big cities on big city salaries wouldn't necessarily receive that same salary to work from home because it wouldn't be sort of adjusted for London rates or whatever. But I just think it would be really interesting, and that's clearly a preference that lots of people have been demonstrating, and the government isn't really going to affect lasting change or do anything very meaningful just by trying to go against the grain of the trend.
I think in terms of both what you just said, which I think is completely true, even though to emphasise that, I think it's a terrible and in many ways depraved decision that those young people are taking. but I think Anoush's point about how it's like, in some ways, it moves you in quite an anti-conservative direction. I think what it reveals is an interesting trait of this kind of flavour of British populism, which is that, like, bluntly, Dom Cummings lives 15 minutes walk from where I am. Other people in Downing Street go to, like, the same nice butchers and delis or whatever. Right, these people love the urban elite. They just also like Brexit. And I think, actually, like, it is like this revealed preference of, oh, but what does that mean for the things I like about my place that I live if I can't effectively force a bunch of young people to come to live here who'd rather not? And so the kind of policy choice becomes, how can we like pull against the grain of what people want rather than go with it? And I'm really sympathetic with wanting to pull against the grain of it. But, you know, for the same reason that I don't like that it's becoming harder for me to buy DVDs or whatever. But like, it doesn't mean that it's like a government, doesn't mean that that's a thing that a government can actually do unless it's willing to actively prohibit people from distance working, which I genuinely think is what you'd probably have to do in a lot of cases.
Definitely. And one other disincentive would probably be that you really have to make housing more secure for far more people if you're gonna go with the trend of people preferring to work from home. Lots of people who have had to work from home in this period are in less than ideal housing scenarios, and that's with the kind of measures that the government put in place to avoid evictions and things like that during the pandemic. So it would mean probably quite a lot of reforms to the private rental sector that, again, run against traditional conservative values, but this government, you know, is supposed to be different.
It is really interesting just how much I think it has, exactly as you say, revealed that this government is not actually at all different from what has gone before, other than actually, weirdly, than it's more squeamish about the operation of free markets. Like, this is just people's preferences causing economic disruption. And in many ways, the correct and classic free market response is, well, you just need to bail out individuals so they don't face destitution. Instead of going, maybe we can give a voucher so that people can think very hard about their revealed preference, decide they're wrong, and change their mind.
I mean, it's probably worth saying that people's revealed preference probably isn't entirely home working, in that normally at some point in discussions about this, people do mention the value of contact with colleagues and the sort of creative potential of those spontaneous social interactions, and then just like the much wider benefits of having. There was a really good piece in The Guardian at the weekend on this. I can't remember the phrase, but like about how psychologists have for a long time talked about the benefit of sort of unimportant peripheral social contacts, that as well as having people in your life who you're very close to, that there's a huge psychological benefit to having lower level friendly interactions with strangers or acquaintances or colleagues who you don't know very well. So I think maybe people's preference will be just for greater flexibility, and, you know, maybe just some people seeing their colleagues, you know, once or twice a month. There are so many features, and this really interesting journalism on this. I think mainly because journalists often work in offices, so they're more interested in this than in other types of work. But, you know, there are stories of workplaces where they got rid of their physical workplace and just the workers meet in a hotel for a meeting about once a month. I think maybe some people would want more flexible working. But even within that qualification, I think it's just absolutely true that the pandemic has accelerated a trend that I think we would have seen anyway, of people moving towards home working.
If you've been enjoying our podcast and want to find out more about what we think, and some of our colleagues too, then why not subscribe to The New Statesman? You can get 12 weeks for £12. Go to newstatesman.com/subscribe12.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
And now it's time for a section we like to call
You Ask Us.
You Ask Us.
So we've got a great question today, which is well-timed because Keir Starmer has hit his first 100 days in office. So this question is, in PMQs, Boris Johnson chided Keir Starmer for being Captain Hindsight, and that was specifically over the issue of asymptomatic transmission of COVID-19. Now, our questioner, Phil Lewis, says, given that I was aware in March that it could be spread by people displaying no symptoms, how does Johnson get away with that kind of slight on Keir Starmer? And what did you think when you heard that, when you were watching PMQs, Alva?
Oh, so I think this is such a good question and such an interesting one, because I don't think that that's an isolated incident of someone, of Boris Johnson saying something questionable at PMQs and not really being picked up on it sufficiently. Because, I mean, almost immediately, people, including our good colleague Patrick Maguire, now departed for the Times. We need to stop mentioning him in every section of the podcast. But, you know, even before PMQs had finished, he and other journalists were sharing minutes of Sage from January, which indicated that there was insufficient evidence, but the early indicators were that asymptomatic transmission was happening. And then anecdotally, as the questioner says, everyone was aware of the possibility of asymptomatic transmission. And it also, more broadly, in the context of the question that Boris Johnson was answering, that was a completely inadequate answer to the question, because the basis on which they hadn't changed the guidance in care homes, or the basis of the guidance on care homes, was that there was no community transmission. Mm. And the implication was that as soon as there was community transmission, the guidance would change. And then there was a huge delay in actually changing the guidance. It had nothing to do with asymptomatic transmission or not. So it's like disingenuous and possibly false on multiple scores. And I think I don't really know is my honest answer for why that one hasn't been picked up on enough. I think my instinct is that for Labour, for example, it doesn't matter at the moment, because Boris Johnson cannot get away with an argument like that in the longer term, because it's like so patently inadequate for explaining what happened around care homes, that like the issue of the scientific guidance on asymptomatic transmission really has nothing to do with the adequate testing or PPE, the policy in care homes, the government policy, how quick that was. So I think maybe the feeling is that that will be looked at in an inquiry, and so there's no need to look at it now. But in general, Boris Johnson says things like that really every time at PMQs, and I think it makes it a challenge covering it to do the sort of the quick take on PMQs, because if, for example, he said that in the context of the Leicester lockdown, Keir Starmer was, you know, there armed with his facts and just off the phone with the mayor of Leicester. And he was pointing out that local authorities in Leicester hadn't received the Pillar 2 data, so the information on community transmission or like information from community testing, until the Thursday before PMQs, which was really, really late and hadn't enabled local services to act quickly enough and had kept them out of the loop. And Boris Johnson said that that was untrue. And I think the challenge as a journalist is you think, well, I don't know on what basis he is saying it's untrue. You can see it in black and white on Twitter, on the mayor of Leicester's official Twitter, him confirming they didn't get that information until the Thursday, which is what Keir Starmer said. And it's basically always the case that you can find the facts online really quickly that Keir Starmer has cited, but you can't really prove an inaccuracy or a falsehood on Boris Johnson's part, because you think, well, maybe the mayor didn't have it, but some other local authorities had it. So this happens really like every week with him. And it's something I plan on writing about in the coming week, because it's not the only trend of Boris Johnson's performance in PMQs. But I think it is a really interesting one, that these things, they didn't escape the notice of the questioner, or actually of quite a lot of people in the case of the asymptomatic one. But just in general, he's able to say that things aren't true, or that he doesn't agree, and there's kind of no serious consequence for him. I don't know, what do the two of you think about it?
My one concern for Keir Starmer with this kind of captain hindsight, well, you know, none of us knew about X, Y, and Z, you know, confusing confusing scientific thing here that doesn't boil down into a soundbite, is that a lot of frontline people who you interview who have been extremely angry about the situation that they've been in and have been through traumatic times will always say, well, you know, I can't really blame the government because no one knew that this would happen. You know, there is a certain level of understanding, and it's dwindling, but there is a certain level of benefit of the doubt given to the government because this is, you know, such an unknown quantity. We've never been through a time like this before in our generation. So I do wonder if the Captain Hindsight type of criticisms of Keir Starmer might be something that they've polled. You know, Alva, you had your scoop about the fact that pretty much every day they're getting public polling in telling them how the public think. Yeah. I think that probably chimes with how quite a lot of people who, yes, they're not particularly impressed with the government's performance, but they still see it from this sort of human, compassionate stance. They probably feel that, you know, well, who is this critic to say that the government did everything wrong from the start when no one knew what they were doing? Stephen, do you think that's an area of vulnerability for Keir Starmer?
Yeah, well, I think one of the really interesting vulnerabilities about, so he's had a successful first 100 days in that people have been introduced to him and they broadly like what they see. But the thing that they've liked about what they've seen is that he has been constructive, or he's performed being constructive. You can argue about whether or not he actually has been constructive, or if he's simply tried to like lay traps for the government in a kind of more subtle way. But the difficulty is I think it means that it's very hard to then move from here I am being instructive to being on the attack. Because I think people have a really strong cognitive bias towards the idea that the government is competent, because the alternative is quite terrifying, right? And so any kind of thing which allows you to go, oh yeah, it is quite difficult, or, well, it is true to say that the Health and Social Care Act is a bit of a mess, is really kind of, it's really seductive, because it means that you don't lie awake at night going, oh God, the people in charge of the health response and the economic response are going to take us over the cliff on the 31st of December as well, and I'm going to, you know, have to live out of a cardboard box, right? And I think that Keir Starmer does have a bit of a vulnerability to that type of argument, because I can't work out how, like, what is the way you go from I'm a reasonable guy who just wants to be constructive to going, but that wasn't hindsight, was it? That was just a lie. And also the other kind of structural PMQs thing, and one of the reasons why when I became polled, I got rid of us going, yeah, who won, who lost, is that if the Prime Minister is halfway, I mean, not even halfway competent, but like if you are a Prime Minister who can walk and chew gum at the same time, you really ought to always draw or win PMQs, because you have the last word. You have the sixth answer. The sixth answer doesn't have to be fair or truthful, or it can be easily rebuttable, right? Yeah, but you get the final TV clip anyway. And his willingness to play fast and loose with established truths is a major asset given the format of PMQs. I think you're right. I think it is a vulnerability in the Starmer project.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Anoush Shekelian, and my colleagues Alva Ray and Stephen Bush. Our producer is Nick Hilton, and our music is Devil by the Devil, licensed under Creative Commons.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.